Welcome to the White Paper. This isn't just another tech podcast. This is where we pull back the curtain on emerging technology and blockchain, where we don't just talk about the future, we break it down before it happens. I'm your host, Nicklin Decker, a venture capitalist out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. But before that, I was the guy in the shadows investigating corporate fraud, embezzlement, and intellectual property theft for Fortune 500 companies. For over 17 years, I tracked hidden assets, exposed fraud rings, and worked alongside federal agencies, district attorneys, vice units, and more, all in the pursuit of the truth. And that's what this podcast is about, truth. In the White Paper, we cut through all the noise, break down blockchain, and make sense of the tech that's changing our world. No jargon, no hype, just real conversations about how emerging technology is impacting business, finance, and everyday life. I'm here to bring clarity where there's confusion and to speak in plain truth, because in Oklahoma, we say what we mean and we mean what we say. So buckle up. The future's coming fast. Let's make sense of it together. Welcome back to the White Paper. I'm your host, Nicklin Decker. Today, in this second edition of The Republic's Conscience, I want to speak directly to Congress about H.R. 3633 and the future of America's monetary architecture. What follows is the first clear, constitutional roadmap for integrating decentralized technology into U.S. legal and regulatory system without sacrificing market integrity, due process, or national security. For years, this space has been defined by confusion. This doctrine brings the clarity that has been missing. The core idea is simple. No digital system can operate outside the Constitution and still function inside the American economy. Decentralization must remain anchored to accountable authority, what I call the chain of consent. The doctrine uses familiar Supreme Court precedent and Article I powers to show how many crypto systems operate in a constitutional vacuum. It solves that by introducing the anchor decentralization test, the first architecture-based standard for classification and enforcement. It also introduces autonomous commodity primitives, sovereign-grade digital tools designed for treasury-level verification and future ABDC infrastructure. The takeaway is straightforward. This doctrine restores constitutional alignment to digital markets and gives Congress a practical, enforceable framework for the next century of American and digital infrastructure. Now, to make this as clear and useful as possible, I'm going to walk Congress through a concise, chapter-by-chapter summary of the executive summary. Each section will be distilled to exactly what lawmakers need to understand. No jargon, no noise, just the constitutional, regulatory, and policy essentials. Chapter 1 establishes the nation's first enforceable legal framework for determining when a digital asset may lawfully be treated as a commodity under the Commodity Exchange Act. For years, this area has drifted through agency inference, market rhetoric, and inconsistent analogies. This chapter restores constitutional discipline to the field. The central finding is straightforward. A digital asset can only be a commodity if it is non-managerial, non-discretionary, economically autonomous, and fully independent of human governance or promotional influence. This is not a policy choice. It is a constitutional requirement granted in the CEA, Supreme Court precedent, including Howey, Reeves, and Foreman, and the separation of powers doctrine. To make this standard enforceable, Chapter 1 introduces the anchored decentralization test. The test has three mandatory prongs: technical, legal, and behavioral decentralization. If an asset fails any one of the three, it cannot be classified as a commodity, regardless of branding, exchange activity, or technical sophistication. The test is operationalized through figures 1, 2, and 3, and reinforced with Table 8 for enforcement clarity. This matters because without a constitutional framework, federal agencies expand jurisdiction by analogy rather than statute. Courts are forced to resolve ambiguity Congress never intended, and private developers effectively write federal law through software design. Chapter 1 corrects this by reasserting congressional authority, constraining administrative overreach under the Major Questions Doctrine, and preserving federalism and state commercial law boundaries. The chapter also restores the Functional Equivalence Doctrine to its original purpose, identifying truly non-managerial instruments, and prevents the misuse to relabel managed or promoter-driven systems as commodities. In parallel, it aligns DAC with the historical lineage of federal commodity law, including the National Gold and Silver Stamping Act and long-standing Treasury and USDA verification standards. Under this model, digital commodities must correspond to verifiable economic reality, carrying traceable digital markings, and support continuous audit chains. To provide Congress with a lawful alternative to speculative digital tokens, Chapter 1 introduces autonomous commodity primitives, digital documents of title aligned with UCC Article 7 and compatible with Treasury-grade reserve systems. ACPs are not securities, currencies, or investment contracts. They are provable, ledger-anchored attestations of real-world value. Finally, this chapter aligns Congress with the Supreme Court's modern textualist posture, reflected in cases such as Slack versus Perini and post-Chevron landscape. Modern courts will ask, who controls it? Who can change it? Who signals about it? Not what the asset is called or where it trades. Bottom line, a digital asset is only a commodity when no one controls it, upgrades it, governs it, or signals about it. Chapter 1 provides Congress with the constitutional, judicially defensible foundation upon which the entire DAC framework is built. Chapter 2 explains how the legal boundary from Chapter 1 is enforced in the real world. If Chapter 1 defines what a commodity must be, non-managerial, non-discretionary, then Chapter 2 defines the system architecture that makes such a thing possible. Together, they function as one constitutional machine. If it can be governed, it is not a commodity. The core structural finding is this: any digital system that requires human management, validators, foundations, multi-sigs, governance tokens, roadmaps, or emergency keys cannot be treated as a commodity under the Commodity Exchange Act. This isn't a policy debate. It's a structural consequence of the CEA, Supreme Court precedent, Article 1 powers, and national security doctrine. To enforce this, Chapter 2 draws a critical line between deployed code and governed code. Deployed code is immutable and has no upgrade path. This can approach commodity status. Governed code has upgrade keys, votes, committees, foundations, or dev control. It is categorically excluded from commodity classification. The chapter also clarifies that governance is law. Slashing rule functions like penalties, voting functions like legislation, and upgrade keys function like an executive branch. A protocol with governance isn't a commodity, it's a jurisdiction. Chapter 2 resolves the mutable commodity paradox. If a digital network can be changed, it cannot be a commodity. Immutability must be provable, not aspirational. The chapter also introduces a key national security rule. Sovereign concentration of validator or hash power is per se managerial control. If a foreign state can steer consensus, commodity status is legally impossible. Finally, Chapter 2 sets the evidentiary standard. Those claiming decentralization must prove non-management through chain forensics, governance audits, and operational history. Assertions are not evidence. The takeaway for Congress is simple. If humans can manage it, it is not a commodity. Chapter 2 paired with Chapter 1 forms a dual pillar lock that keeps digital markets constitutionally coherent. Chapter 3 turns from digital assets to the Constitution itself. If Chapters 1 and 2 answer what a commodity is and what its architecture must be, Chapter 3 asks the only question that ultimately matters. Is the architecture constitutionally permissible at all? Novelty doesn't matter. Conformity to the Constitution does. This chapter introduces four enforcement protocols. Table 18, distinguishing verifiable decentralization from marketing claims. Figure 3, the constitutional decision framework covering the Commerce Clause, non-delegation, and due process. Table 19, keeping statutory, architectural, and constitutional terminology aligned. And Table 20, mapping structure directly to the case law. The first constitutional issue is the Commerce Clause. Stateless systems with no operators, no governance, and no identifiable point of control are not neutral. They are jurisdictionally unanchored. Without a constitutional hook, Congress cannot classify them at all. Next is the chain of consent. Authority must trace from the people to the Constitution, to the branches, to institutions, to markets. Systems that rely on anonymous actors, token votes, or algorithmic enforcement break that chain and cannot be treated as commodities. Chapter 3 then applies the non-delegation doctrine. Protocol governance upgrades, forks, inflation schedules. It's lawmaking. When done by token voters, anonymous developers, or offshore foundations, it becomes unconstitutional private rulemaking. Due process adds a final screen. Rules must be predictable. If algorithms or governance can slash funds, freeze assets, or retroactively change standards, the system is governed, not deterministic, and governed systems cannot be commodities. The proof of burden lies entirely on those claiming decentralization. Only cryptographically verifiable non-management counts. Self-attested decentralization does not. Together, chapters 1, 2, and 3 form the constitutional lock. If it can be governed, it cannot be a commodity. And if it cannot meet constitutional standards, it cannot be recognized at all. Code does not override the Constitution. Chapter 4 performs the legal reset that modern digital asset law has never completed. It restores the constitutional meaning of a commodity in the programmable age. The Commodity Exchange Act was written for inert objects, things like wheat, oil, and gold, objects that cannot change themselves, govern users, or evolve through discretion. Most digital assets do those things, yet are still being labeled as commodities through narrative instead of structure. That misclassification has destabilized federal jurisdiction and blurred constitutional lines. Chapter 4 reconstructs, not expands, the legal definition of a digital commodity so it once again aligns with Article 1 limits, the non-delegation doctrine, due process, and the original logic of the CEA. Under DAC, a digital commodity is a non-managerial, non-discretionary, structurally neutral object whose operation cannot be altered, directed, or influenced by any identifiable party. This definition imposes four mandatory neutrality requirements: legal neutrality, economic neutrality, technical neutrality, and behavioral neutrality. If any neutrality fails, the asset is not a commodity. The resulting structural reality is straightforward. Bitcoin qualifies. Nearly every other digital asset fails due to upgrades, governance, foundations, or discretionary control. That outcome is constitutional, not ideological. Chapter 4 formalizes decentralization as an evidentiary test, not a branding claim. The presence of a managerial shadow, foundations, roadmaps, coordinated forks, token governance, is conclusive proof of governance and eliminates commodity eligibility. Federal jurisdiction is clarified, not expanded. CFTC oversees only constitutionally neutral commodities. The SEC receives automatic jurisdiction where managerial effort, discretion, or profit from others exist. Structure decides classification, ending interagency conflict. This chapter creates a five-part constitutional gate: jurisdictional anchoring, constitutional compliance, immutability, absence of managerial control, and resistance to discretionary influence. failure of any part makes the system governed, and governed systems cannot be commodities. For Congress, the doctrine is simple. If humans can manage it, it's not a commodity. If rules can change, it's not neutral. If profit depends on human effort, it's a security. Chapter 4 restores a constitutionally defensive, politically neutral standard. No new powers, no new tests, no new legislation, only a return to the rule of law. Chapter 5 addresses the most important constitutional reality in digital governance. So-called decentralized systems are not autonomous. They are governed by people, and under U.S. law, authority attaches to human power, not to branding, marketing, or architectural claims. The constitutional rule is simple. If people can influence outcomes, management exists, decentralization collapses, and commodity status fails. Modern digital systems try to diffuse responsibility through distributed nodes, anonymous governance, DAOs, oracles, and community ownership. But America has never recognized architecture-based immunity when human discretion is present. Where a human can influence system behavior, law attaches to that human, and the system becomes governed. To operationalize this, DAC creates a three-part functional accountability framework. One, ontological role, who the person is in the system. Two, functional authority, what they can cause or influence. Three, attributable control, whether removing them changes the outcome. If removing a person changes system behavior, that person is managerial. No title or contract required. The chapter applies this to key actors. Validators become managers when they censor or coordinate. Oracles are per se managerial because they inject discretion. DAO voters are collective managers. Developers and maintainers hold latent control. Latent power is legal power. Unused authority still collapses decentralization. Chapter 5 establishes that coordination equals governance. When actors align to produce system outcomes, the law sees implied agency, joint enterprise, and functional control, not decentralization. The chapter also introduces the founder doctrine. Founders are permanent structural risk vectors unless total and irreversible severance is proven. If a founder can still speak, guide upgrades, influence culture, or hold repository keys, the system remains centralized. Finally, Chapter 5 destroys the myth of stateless protocols. Jurisdiction follows people, not software. If people run it, it exists somewhere. If code changes, someone changed it. If governance exists, jurisdiction attaches. This stabilizes AML and OFAC, sanctions enforcement, and treasury oversight. The legislative rule is clear. If human discretion exists, governance exists. Commodity classification is legally impossible. People run systems. People cause outcomes. And where people can influence systems, the Constitution requires the law to attach. Chapter 6 places decentralized digital systems back inside the United States constitutional structure. It rejects the idea that code is law and restores a basic principle. Wherever discretion, power, or human control exist, constitutional limits apply. This lets courts and policymakers evaluate digital systems without treating technology as an exception to American law. The first major shift is the collapse of Chevron deference. Agencies no longer get to expand their jurisdiction by interpretation. Courts now control statutory meaning. That means agencies cannot redefine commodity or security to fit new technologies, and Congress must supply precise definitions, which DAC provides. Second, decentralized systems are deliberately engineered to defeat Article 3 standing by obscuring injury, causation, and defendants. DAC restores judicial standing by applying functional reality. Where people exercise discretion, liability attaches. Where coordination exists, causation exists. where influence exists, redressability exists. Third, constitutional rights fully apply. Digital systems can violate Fourth Amendment analogs through surveillance-like tracking, due process through irreversible execution, equal protection through wealth-based governance, and procedural rights through penalty without appeal structures. Code does not escape constitutional limits. It inherits them. Fourth, protocols that freeze funds, impose penalties, or adjudicate disputes function as private governments. U.S. doctrine does not allow binding governance without accountability. When systems exercise power, they inherit constitutional restraint. Finally, DAX survives judicial review because it asks court to enforce existing constraints, textualism, separation of powers, non-delegation, standing, and due process, rather than invent new ones. The bottom line for Congress, Treasury, and the National Security Council is clear. DAC prevents agencies from inventing law, preserves constitutional rights, blocks private shadow governments, and provides a litigation-resistant framework that stabilizes markets and protects the Republic's constitutional order. Chapter 7 restores constitutional discipline to the CFTC by tying its authority back to the actual text of the Commodity Exchange Act. For years, regulators have stretched definitions by analogy to fit new technologies. After Chevron's collapse, that is no longer legally sustainable. Jurisdiction must now follow structure, not narrative. The first finding is straightforward. Digital markets have outgrown the CFTC's original statutory design. The agency was built to regulate identifiable markets, standardized commodities, centralized price discovery, and tangible derivative instruments. Most digital systems do not fit these prerequisites. Under DAC, if a system has managerial discretion, governance levers, or upgrade authority, it cannot qualify as a commodity under the CEA. Second, jurisdictional inflation is now constitutionally unstable. Courts require clear statutory authorization, reject informal expansion, and enforce strict separation of powers. If the CFTC overreaches, enforcement actions will be struck down, weakening federal credibility and destabilizing markets. Third, the chapter introduces the concept of the managerial shadow, validator collusion, oracle manipulation, MEV extraction, governance capture, and emergency developer interventions. These are not edge cases. They are proof that the system is managed. And managed systems cannot be commodities. Fourth, traditional CEA market integrity doctrine fails when no real market exists. Most decentralized systems lack centralized exchanges, unified order books, or identifiable counterparties. When market structure dissolves, CFTC authority cannot constitutionally attach. Fifth, decentralization does not strip jurisdiction. It must be proven through three facts: no managerial control, no discretionary behavior, and no human jurisdictional anchors. If any fail, the system is governed, and commodity classification collapses. Chapter 7 gives Congress a strategic advantage. It rejects unconstitutional overreach, preserves fraud and theft enforcement, protects innovation, prevents regulatory voids, and shields future legislation from judicial reversal. The bright line rule is simple. No management leads to possible commodity regulation, and any management leads to not a commodity, therefore leads to CFTC jurisdictional ending. This protects the Republic's constitutional order while keeping markets stable and enforceable. Chapter 8 provides Congress with a constitutionally durable framework for applying securities law to decentralized digital systems. It rejects the idea that decentralization eliminates management and restores the economic reality principle at the heart of Howey. If investors rely on coordinated human discretion to create or preserve value, the asset is a security, regardless of labels, code, or structure. The chapter demonstrates that consensus mechanisms are not neutral. Validators select transactions, developers ship upgrades, governance holders change rules, and oracles inject discretionary data. These are managerial acts. Under DAC, when consensus requires discretion, management exists. When management exists, decentralization collapses. Chapter 8 also reframes disclosure. It must follow power, not paperwork. Congress must ask, who can change the protocol? Who controls supply mechanics, fees, governance keys, or economic parameters? If identifiable humans hold these levers, disclosure is required even without a corporation. The chapter also establishes that promotional speech, founder roadmaps, token marketing, conference signaling, coordinated governance, is legally managerial when it shapes investor expectations. And governance tokens function as voting securities because they grant economic rulemaking power. Delegation of economic governance equals security classification. Finally, the chapter addresses volatility as a prudential risk signal. Extreme drawdowns and liquidity shocks place digital assets in the same fragility class as pre-1934 markets. Regulatory interest is driven not by hostility to technology, but by the need to protect market stability. The bottom line for Congress, Treasury, and the National Security Council is clear. If people drive outcomes, it's a security. If discretion exists, disclosure applies. If voting power exists, registration is required. If volatility signals systemic fragility, prudential oversight is justified. Chapter 9 explains that digital protocol architecture is not legally neutral. When code allocates power, constrains behavior, or controls economic outcomes, it functions as law, even if that law is written in software instead of statute. The core risk identified is that many so-called decentralized systems embed hidden governance through upgrade authority, multi-sig control, validator coordination, governance tokens, and oracle dependencies. These are not technical conveniences. They are de facto regulatory powers being exercised outside constitutional accountability. To address this, the chapter introduces a constitutional translation rule. When code governs behavior, it is legal conduct. When architecture allocates authority, it is governance. And when system design creates foreseeable harm, it creates legal duty. This lets Congress regulate digital markets by structure, not marketing. DAC then establishes a three-part anchoring test for true decentralization. Technical decentralization, no actor can alter outcomes. Behavioral decentralization, no actor can influence markets. Jurisdictional decentralization, no concentrated point of control. If any prong fails, decentralization fails as a legal status. The implications are simple. If people can influence outcomes, the asset is not a commodity. If they can steer value, it functions as a security. And if architecture creates dependency, existing law already applies. This matters to the Treasury Department and to the National Security Council because unregulated systems with invisible governance create systemic financial risk, evade national oversight, and undermine sovereign monetary control. The policy value for Congress is clear. Lawmakers do not need to understand code. They only need to understand that structure determines legal reality. Decentralization is not a slogan. It is an engineering condition. Where design concentrates power, the law must follow. Chapter 10 explains how the doctrine of anchor and decentralization, or DAC, holds up in a post-Chevron world, a world where courts, not agencies, determine statutory meaning and constitutional boundaries. DAC is not designed to bind the Supreme Court or ask judges to create new doctrine. Instead, it is engineered to remain fully compatible with the court's modern interpretive posture. The chapter grounds DAC in first principles: textual clarity, structural coherence, non-delegation discipline, major questions restraint, and due process intelligibility. It does not rely on agency discretion. DAT gives courts what they increasingly demand: measurable structural tests, architecture-based factual standards, and clean constitutional evaluation pathways. Judges remain interpreters, not technocrats or policymakers. Under the major questions doctrine, DAC assumes congressional primacy. Silence is treated as a limitation, not a permission slip, for agencies to expand jurisdiction. DAC's design builds due process into the architecture itself, delivering clear notice, predictable classification, and reduced enforcement arbitrariness. Actors can understand legal posture before enforcement occurs. The judicial role of DAC is simple. Courts function as a neutral measurers of structure, guardians of jurisdiction, and protectors of legal clarity. DAC does not predict Supreme Court outcomes and does not push the court to expand federal power. It preserves judicial sovereignty, separation of powers, and constitutional order. The bottom line? DAC is not aggressive towards courts. It is architected for them. It aligns with existing doctrine rather than attempting to reshape it, making it one of the few digital asset frameworks capable of surviving judicial review in the post-Chevron era. Chapter 11 makes one point unmistakably clear. Decentralized digital systems do not exist outside the Constitution. If a network touches U.S. users, markets, infrastructure, or financial stability, Congress has full authority under the Commerce Clause, regardless of whether the system calls itself decentralized, stateless, or autonomous. Statelessness is a technical strategy, not a legal exemption. This matters because many digital networks are intentionally engineered to avoid accountability by removing corporate forms, geographical anchors, and visible governance. But the Constitution regulates effects, not labels. If Americans are affected, constitutional authority attaches automatically. The chapter establishes three constitutional conclusions. First, no system is outside U.S. jurisdiction. Value moving through the U.S. economy is subject to congressional power. Second, algorithms cannot substitute for Congress. Software cannot write laws, impose penalties, or reassign rights. When private actors can change code or influence outcomes, the system becomes private governance, not neutral infrastructure. Third, protocols that seize assets, freeze funds, or impose penalties are exercising sovereign-type authority. And without explicit congressional authorization, this is unconstitutional private delegation. Chapter 11 also reinforces that due process applies even in code. Economic systems must provide clear rules, predictable operation, advance notice before rights change, and meaningful recourse. Systems that shift rules suddenly or penalize users without process are constitutionally defective. DAC's value to Congress is its simplicity. If a system touches U.S. commerce, it must be jurisdictionally anchored. If humans can influence outcomes, it is managed, not neutral. If rules shift without notice, due process is violated. DAC protects innovation without surrendering constitutional authority and prevents private software from becoming unaccountable shadow governance. The bottom line? Decentralization does not cancel the Constitution. Code cannot replace Congress. Due process cannot be engineered away. DAC is not anti-technology. It is pro-Constitution, pro-rule of law, and pro-national stability. Chapter 12 brings the entire doctrine of anchor decentralization together. It explains that digital asset law did not fail because technology moved too fast. It failed because constitutional structure was never rebuilt for the programmable era. Systems were forced into legacy legal boxes without reconstructing the foundations that make lawful regulation possible: jurisdiction, non-delegation, and due process. DAC corrects that failure. Importantly, DAC does not ban technology, expand federal power, or predict court outcomes. It restores the constitutional preconditions that must exist before any system can claim decentralization or autonomy. That means restoring congressional primacy, judicial intelligibility, due process predictability, and non-delegation discipline. Under DAC, decentralization is not a marketing claim. It is a constitutional condition. A system is only lawful if it proves verifiable architecture with no human control, jurisdictional anchoring, managerial neutrality, non-discretionary rule logic, and traceable authority through the chain of consent. The chapter gives Congress a three-tier constitutional test: verifiable decentralization, verifiable neutrality, and verifiable anchoring. Failure of any one tier triggers a one-strike rule. Developer control, governance voting, treasury discretion, upgrade keys, token issuance, or foundation influence all constitute legal centralization. For Congress, DAX supplies clean definitions, evidence-based filters, and constitutional safe harbors that protect lawful innovation. It can be integrated into CEA amendments, Securities Act clarifications, APA modernization, or through the updated, in Appendix A, H.R. 3633, as the legislative chassis. Systems that meet DAC's structural criteria gain clarity, reduced enforcement risk, and judicial durability. Courts do not need new powers. DAC aligns with textualism, the major questions doctrine, non-delegation, due process, and existing securities jurisprudence. The bottom line? Decentralization must be proven, not claimed. Code cannot replace Congress. Algorithms cannot substitute for consent. And stateless design cannot defeat the Constitution. The strategic outcome is a stable market, protected innovation, strengthened congressional authority, preserved judicial legitimacy, and enhanced national economic security. All without expanding federal reach. As we close, I want to leave you with a thought that rests at the center of this doctrine. There are moments in a nation's life when technology outpaces law and progress outpaces understanding. These are not moments for retreat. They are moments for remembering what the Republic is made of. More than two centuries ago, our forebears insisted that there would be no taxation without representation. That phrase wasn't a slogan. It was the architecture of a new civilization. They built a nation on a simple conviction that no power, financial, political, or military, should move without consent. That the right to govern and the right to trade are bound by a single principle. Legitimacy must trace back to the people. That truth has not changed. What has changed is the world in which it must now be defended. Today, value moves not by coin or paper, but by code. It crosses borders instantly, silently, often beyond the reach of the laws that once defined economic sovereignty. And in this new domain, the meaning of no taxation without representation becomes deeper. Because decentralization without consent is not liberty, it is evasion. It is the quiet withdrawal of citizenship from its covenant. When systems of value operate beyond the trace of law, they cease to be tools of freedom and become tools of escape. Escape from responsibility, from transparency, and from the very republic that sustains them. To move wealth without representation is simply the inverse of taxation without representation. The direction changes, the violation does not. Decentralization was meant as a promise to distribute power so that no one institution could hold it captive. But freedom, untethered from accountability, does not spread, it fractures. True decentralization is not the absence of order. It is ordered shared. It must be anchored not just in code, but in conscience. This is why the chain of consent matters. It is the unseen thread that binds liberty to law. It is what allows a nation to grow more complex without becoming less accountable. In a world where transactions move faster than thought and anonymity can masquerade as virtue, the chain of consent reminds us that the strength of the Republic is not in secrecy, but in trust. And today, modern cryptography gives us the tools to preserve that trust. Zero-knowledge proofs, privacy-preserving ledgers, and non-custodial systems allow us to protect individual privacy while preserving national accountability. These are not threats to freedom, they are the next instruments of it, if and only if they remain bound to the principle that every power must be traceable to the consent of the people. Because consent is not a line on a contract. Consent is the signature of civilization. The founders could not have imagined distributed ledgers or self-executing code, but they understood something far more permanent, that freedom is sustained not by sentiment, but by structure. The structure of consent. To abandon that discipline today would be to unwind the very sentence upon which this republic was born. If a digital system cannot be held accountable, it cannot be called free. If it operates outside representation, it stands outside the Constitution. If it replaces consent with automation, it stops being progress and becomes something else entirely, a quiet form of anarchy, the rule of code without conscience. Our task is not to halt innovation, but to guide it, to weave the chain of consent into the fabric of the digital age, to ensure that every system of value remains answerable to the republic and to the people it serves. We are not the first generation to face this tension between liberty and order, but we may be the first to decide it in code. Let us decide it well. Let us remind the world that freedom to endure must always carry a return address, that the strength of this nation is not in its technology, but in its consent. Because an economy without consent is tyranny by code. A nation without traceability is sovereignty without soul. And if the republic is to endure through every new medium and mechanism that time may bring, it will be because we remembered this. Freedom is not the absence of restraint. It is the presence of responsibility. This is the white paper, and this is the beginning of the chain of consent, the restoration of the oldest American truth, that power is legitimate only when it returns to the people.